Mark, I appreciate you doing this, my friend.
Hey, good to talk to you, Mike.
Montreal dude, can I assume Canadians in hockey, Expos, Raptors, and the Buffalo Bills?
I'm not into the NFL, so not the Buffalo Bills, but the Saskatchewan Roughriders of the Canadian Football League.
Of course.
This is the only professional sports team in Saskatchewan, and it is followed with a passion by people in that province. So I have an old friend, for example, who's written books about the English novelist Somerset Maugham and about other literary topics, and he's also written a history of the Saskatchewan Roughriders.
Oh, that's actually pretty cool. Now, what about one team you can watch win a championship in your lifetime? Who would it be?
The Detroit Red Wings.
Really? Why is that?
Because when I was a kid growing up in Western Canada, Gordie Howe, the great Red Wings player, Gordie Howe,
Number
saw
nine, of course.
me in the basement of a department store in my local town. And then my family moved to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and Gordie Howe had grown up in Floral, Saskatchewan, which is a couple of miles outside town. So ever since then, I've been a lifelong Red Wings fan. And we did win the Stanley Cup in 97, 98, 2002, and 2008.
That is pretty cool. Now, I know you have ties to the UK, which we're going to talk about. Soccer fan, football club, or not really?
I guess Liverpool in the UK.
Very fair, very fair. How's the move going? I know we're trying to schedule this around the eclipse and the move. How's the move going?
It's going slowly. It's a big thing to sell a house and buy a new house, so it's tough.
What food are you going to miss most from home? What place around you that they're not going to have where you're going? Like, wow, we might have to go back travel there to get what?
Well, listen, Mike, I'm now risking you cutting me off completely, okay? Because I'm going to say that I will miss the best bagels in the world, which are not the ones sold in Manhattan, but the ones sold in Montreal.
Which is true, by the way. Montreal has amazing bagels, so I will give that to you. I will.
That's amazing. Okay, can I try Montreal smoked meat as opposed to pastrami, or is that a leap too far?
It Schwartz? Is that the smoked meat place?
That's one of the smoked meat places in Montreal, yep.
Yes.
To be
Rhodes,
honest,
yeah.
Montreal smoked meat is, I think, pretty similar to New York pastrami, and I wouldn't claim that it's better. It's just a little different. But Montreal bagels are a work of art on their own.
Now, Mark, you're a Rhodes Scholar. Explain to me this in layman terms, my friend. When you get the scholarship to be a Rhodes Scholar, are you automatically a scholar, or do you have to pass the course? I know it might sound like a silly question, but people are like, do you have to pass something to be considered, or once you obtain the scholarship, are you a Rhodes Scholar?
Once you win the scholarship, then you're a Rhodes Scholar, even if you fall flat on your face and never achieve anything.
That's actually pretty cool. Now, have you ever used that in an argument? You know, if you're in an argument, like, okay, what are you, a brain surgeon? What are you, a Rhodes Scholar? Has it ever come up in an argument? And don't lie to me, please.
No, I've never used it in an argument. I never have. I'm trying to remember a New Yorker cartoon from a few years ago. In which, or maybe it was Dilbert, in which one of them says to another one, "If you're a Rhodes Scholar, why are you doing temp work?" I had that on my office door for a while.
Traveling is one of my biggest passions, and I'm always on the prowl for travel books. There's really not many really good travel books. And it was your title, it was the cover, it was everything in between that led me to your newest book, Strange Bewildering Time, Istanbul to Kathmandu in the Last Year of the Hippie Trail. First of all, congratulations on the book, because it's always
Thank you
such
very
an
much.
accomplishment.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you have a ritual or something when you hit send for the last time and you're sending it to the publisher, you're done with the book? Do you have a ritual like, oh my God, I'm done? But how do you celebrate?
I probably celebrate with a good scotch, a single malt scotch. But there was another one of my books that I have to tell you the strangest thing happened. I wrote a book about a figure from Canadian history who was kind of a notorious character. There's no real equivalent in the States to this guy. He was a high-level bureaucrat responsible for Indian affairs, and he was also a poet. And the two aspects of his work were totally at odds with each other because he was writing romantic poetry and he was running the boarding school system designed to cancel Indigenous culture. Anyway, I wrote a kind of creative nonfiction biography of this guy. His name was Duncan Campbell Scott. And I wrote the book and I, did the editing, did the proofreading. The last thing was the index because a book like this needs an index. So I compiled the index. And then I proofread the index, which you can only do when the book's been typeset, and I press send. And that night, I had a very strange dream about Duncan Campbell Scott. So having researched and written this guy's story for a couple of years, I get to the end of the work, which is the proofreading the index, and then I dream about him. And it was a very weird and uncanny dream. He and I were sitting in a restaurant, and everyone else in the restaurant was in color and was laughing and joking and having a good meal. And he and I were in black and white, and we were staring at each other.
That's how engrossed you become in your books, I guess.
Exactly. That's how books take over your head.
Have you ever seen anyone reading one of your books in public yet?
Yeah, I did see them one. I wrote a travel book about endangered languages called Spoken Here, and I was on the Montreal subway system and I noticed someone reading that. And what I would love to say is that I became best friends with that guy immediately, but unfortunately, it was the stop where I had to get out, and I was just standing up and I noticed, oh my God, he's reading Spoken Here. And then it was my stop and I had to get out.
So you didn't
So I
approach them?
wondered if I'd slightly hallucinated, but I know I hadn't. So.
Oh, man. 45 years have passed since you left school and decided to travel throughout Asia and the Middle East in 1978. Why now? What made you want to write the book now? Not 10 years, 20 years. Why such a long gap till writing this book?
One of the answers I don't tell most people is that I was intimidated by Paul Theroux. Paul Theroux,
Of
the
course.
great American novelist and travel writer, he wrote a book called The Great Railway Bazaar, which was traveling by train across Asia. And that book came out in 1975 and it sold a ton of copies. And when I was a young man, I didn't want to be a journalist, which is what I became. I wanted to be a poet. And so I took all these notes during the trip. And I thought the notes would be helpful for me in writing poems, which indeed they were. But I thought Paul Theroux had kind of done that. I thought Theroux had written the Asian travel book and no one else could do it as entertainingly or as successfully as Theroux. And then finally, so many years had passed and I realized people weren't reading that particular book. They might be reading other books by Paul Theroux, but they weren't reading that one so much anymore. So I could go back to these notes. So that is it. Really, part of the reason why it took me so long is the anxiety of influence, the anxiety of
Oof.
Paul Theroux's example, and the other reason is just in a way I don't know if I was ready to write this because it was a hell of a difficult book to write. To go back to my old notes, and to see what was there, but also to figure out what was not there, and to try and meld together the past, the present, the younger self, the present self, what's happened in these countries since then, what was happening back then. It was not an easy book to write, and I'm not sure I could have done it successfully while I was younger.
You had to juggle so much. You went, it was such a difficult part for you. You're talking about your younger self, yourself now, a little political, a little bit about the population change. Was that tough to juggle? Because there's probably 500 more pages you could have written. You had to condense everything. Was that difficult to juggle all that?
Yeah, it was pretty difficult to juggle. I was just trying to keep a bunch of different balls in the air and hope that none of them crashed down too hard,
The title says it all, The Last Year of the Hippie Trail. Why was it the last year? I know that was the route everyone took. What was the Afghan War, Iran? Was it a lot of stuff? Why is the hippie trail done?
Mainly it was the Iranian Revolution, which
Okay.
happened in January 79 when the Shah was forced to flee the country. And of course, Iran changed totally. With the Ayatollahs coming in, the Islamic Republic being established. And then pretty soon after that was established, there was war with Iraq. And so that was also made it very difficult to travel in Asia. And we all know what then went on to happen in Iraq. At the same time, what happened when I was actually in Iran in the spring of 1978 was that the Afghan borders closed down. Now, everyone remembers, or many people remember, that the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in December 1979. What's not so often remembered is why they invaded Afghanistan, which was that 18 months earlier, there had been a Marxist revolution in Kabul, where the king of Afghanistan was deposed, had to flee the country. And so the first communist regime that came in 78, they shut down the borders. And it was still possible after that to travel across Afghanistan. I believe Rick Steves, in fact, did it in the fall of
Oh,
1978.
wow.
But then Afghanistan was essentially closed to travel. and Iran was completely closed to travel. So it was still possible to travel through Turkey, and of course, it was also possible to fly to India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Bangkok, and so on. In other words, many of the places that people on the old hippie trail visited are still very accessible, even to travelers who aren't as intrepid as you are, Mike. But the actual overland route through Iran and Afghanistan ended in 1978.
You think of hippie trail and backpacking, you're thinking of a big backpack, maybe a little luggage. How many notebooks did you have? Because you vividly had details from 45 years ago. Were you going there with a huge notebook, journals? There's no iPhone to throw it in notes. How many notebooks did you have with you?
I had three red notebooks, soft covered notebooks. They were not these, and now I would love to have a moleskin notebook, but moleskin notebooks are a bit heavier. These were just three really slim unlined notebooks. And I mention unlined because my handwriting was really small. In those days, it was small and neat. Now it's small and totally illegible. I could not, if I made a journey now, or when I make journeys now, I have to record my impressions, my notes by other means, electronic means. I couldn't do it by hand now.
So you know, you went in there at the beginning of this journey. I'm going to start doing a journal. You knew that from the beginning, right? And did you know, you said poem wise, you started just taking meticulous notes right away, right from the jump?
Yeah, I did pretty much. I did.
Wow.
I'd made some notes on previous journeys, but nothing like as detailed as this. But then what happened was that, after getting the train from London to Istanbul, I was traveling with a young woman named Claire, a young English woman. And after a couple of weeks, we were in Turkey, in a rural area of Turkey, and we were befriended by a couple of Turkish guys. Well, one in particular. And he had a friend who came along for a journey. This was in a region of central Turkey called Cappadocia, and I went up a hill with a guy we got to know fairly well. Claire was left behind. She didn't want to climb up this hill, so she was left behind with the other guy. The other guy immediately assaulted her, tried to rape her, and so after that, what happened? He didn't succeed, I should say. That she fought him off, and then when I came down the hill with the other guy, we found Claire crying in the parking lot, very upsetting. So what happened after that, though, was that Claire and I felt that we couldn't split up, even for periods of half an hour or an hour. We had to stick together, and since we were not sexual partners, we were friends, not lovers. This created a lot of tension when you're traveling with someone and you can't get away from them. It's tough. I mean, we remained on, reasonably good terms throughout the trip, but still, it was tense at times. But the reason I'm telling you all this, Mike, is because it made the journals even more essential for me, because I needed some private space where I could record what I'd seen and what was going on inside my head, record my frustrations with all kinds of things that I didn't want to let out, totally, in person with Claire, because we had to get through Iran, we had to get through Pakistan, we had to get through India. We couldn't just split up and be apart from each other for a few days. Claire and I were kind of, we were a unit for those 3 months, and so keeping the journals became even more important, not just on a kind of literary level, if you like, but a psychological level too.
The hippie trail, it's been like romanticized. It's always like, oh, the hippie trail back in the 70s. I know it was like art and culture, enlightenment, it was everything in between. Was it also like a party thing too? Like the same with the Southeast Asia one is now. People go to Bangkok, and was it also like a party trip? Because there was no party documented in the book. Not that I got the book for your partying, but was there partying going on and stuff like that, or not really?
Not very much, but this was partly because Claire and I were both maybe more serious-minded than a lot of the travelers were. But, the thing was that earlier on, in like the heyday of the hippie trail, if you like, the late 60s, early 70s, there were a lot more drugs that were involved. What had happened, and partly this was a result of the Nixon administration, saying to Nepal, for example, which was the culmination of our trip, Kathmandu, Nepal, an amazing city. But cannabis was legal in Nepal through the 60s into the early 70s. And then the Nixon administration cracked down and said, you can't keep, you've got to make this stuff illegal. So they did. So I mean, it was still easily available, but it was not party central anymore. And we were very well aware that in Iran, even though it was still the Shah's regime, even though the politics was still fairly westernized, the social mores had already swung towards a more strict interpretation of Islam. So outside the capital city, Tehran, in much of Iran, when we traveled, women were already veiled and wearing the burqas and so on. And in Pakistan, that's where we really ran into some bit of militant Islam. The previous prime minister of Pakistan was at the time on death row. Things were pretty tense politically, and Islam was growing in strength there. So compared to 5 or 10 years earlier, there was less partying and more cautious partying among the Westerners on the trail than you might think from the phrase hippie trail.
That's interesting. My mom moved a few months ago, and I was cleaning out boxes, helping her move, and they were my old yearbooks from around 20, 25 years ago. And it was like what we wrote to each other. I'm like, oh my God, we were such idiots. Look at us. Going back 45 years now, how many times did you cringe reading the passages like, oh my God? Because there was one that stuck out to me. I think it was something like, I was cheering or rooting for the rebels, but I didn't know who they were. Like you were already like anti-establishment. How many, not that one, but how many other ones like made you cringe? Like, oh my God, was this really me 45 years ago?
Every single page. No, I think in essence, I'm still the same person I was, and I think most people kind of feel that way. But my God, the things I said, the things I wrote, the most of all the pompousness I had. I was a fairly arrogant, pompous kind of person, and even, I like what here's one thing that made me cringe. I was on a train and I got the impulse to write a poem. And I started writing, and this was when it was really hot. There's no air conditioning on the train. I think this was in Pakistan. So the temperature would have been, let's say, minimum in the 80s, possibly in the 90s. And I got the idea of writing a poem about an ice cream cone. So I wrote a poem that began, "The ice cream cone you eat will soon be part of you." And I looked back in my journal and I thought, what the F word? But that's who I was.
Well, that must have been wild, though, to still re obviously a lot of it didn't make the thing, but it was weird, must be, to like look back at yourself, right?
Kind of weird. I mean, at times I was a little bit endearing, I suppose, but 10% endearing, 90% exasperating.
Tourism obviously has changed so much in 5 years. Forget about 45 years. Right now, we can be in anywhere in the world. We're getting texts, emails. We can do whatever, FaceTime. You know what blew me away the most, and I've heard about it, but you did such a great job of vividly putting it there, is you'd have to go to the post office in the main city to get a letter. So how did that work? Did you tell your girlfriend or your friends, hey, I'm going to be in Kathmandu in a few months. I'm going to be in New Delhi. I'm going to be in Bangkok. How'd that work? You told people where you were going to be, and you just showed up at the post office?
Exactly. Yep. Because we had a very rough schedule. We didn't know day by day, but we had a pretty fair idea of when we were going to be in Tehran, when we were going to be in Delhi. One of my the first things I felt when I heard about the borders closing in Afghanistan was, shit, I'm not going to be able to get to the post office in Kabul. I'm not going to be able to pick up the mail there,
Wow.
but of course there were no smartphones, and so this meant that we were reliant on and there were almost no guidebooks either. We had one really inadequate guidebook that had been published in Australia by the Australian Union of Students, and it was pretty good for Southeast Asia where we weren't going. And then, so even though it was called Student Guide to Asia, whoever wrote it and in Sydney had got kind of they were losing steam, let's say, the further west they got. So this book had something like 60 pages on Indonesia, 40 pages on Singapore, and 5 pages on Turkey. So it
No.
was not a great guidebook. But at that point in 1978, there were no Lonely Planets, there were no rough guides, So, and everything, like I said, with no smartphones, everything had to be done on paper. So, I remember I had a good editor for this book, and one of the things he suggested was when I said at one point, we checked our map to see something or other. He said, make it clear that you're not looking at your phone. So I added the word fold out to the book.
Yes,
So
yes.
we checked our fold out map just to remind people that we couldn't, look at Google Maps.
What? It's so easy to say, but even 10 years ago with MapQuest, driving somewhere, I go 5 minutes away, you throw it away. So the fact that you did this just makes every travel achievement, like, it blew me away, really, reading it. It really did. Some personal stuff. You traveled, like you said, with a female Claire. You both had significant others. Did either of you guys stay with your significant others from college?
We both did.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really wild.
So three and both of these were relationships that had started only in the previous few months. So 3 months away, maybe everyone should do that when they get together with someone who's immediately split up for a few months.
What was her reaction to the book, Claire? Obviously, you sent it to her. What was her reaction?
I was in fear and trembling.
Yeah.
I didn't stay in close touch with her over the decades, just a Christmas card or whatever, or from time to time. And finally, I thought, okay, I've got to let her know I'm doing this. So I had to ask a mutual friend for her current email address because I didn't have it anymore. And I wrote to her and told her I was doing this. And she said, good. And I said, would you like to see a copy of the manuscript? And she said, sure. And what I suggested was that I use another name for her. I was willing to call her, Fiona or Rosamund. I was thinking, what are English upper middle class names that she could become? And I was pretty keen on Fiona. And she said, no, I'll use my real name. And then she read the manuscript and she corrected me on maybe 10 or 15 points and reminded me of a few other things I hadn't recalled. And the only thing was that, she asked me to take out a line where I'm talking finally in the late in the book where I'm talking about the frustrations that we both felt with each other, and I said both of us began to wish we'd traveled with other travel partners, and she said I don't remember ever wishing that.
Oh, wow, that's actually really nice.
Yeah, I know. So I took that line out.
Wow, that's actually really cool. And obviously, it's difficult to travel with people to begin with. And again, there was no, you guys weren't hooking up. So that must have been very difficult on so many levels. That's pretty wild. And the trip itself, did you enjoy the ride? Looking back now, of course, we enjoy old trips. I know hers was different than you. She was, sexually harassed, sexually assaulted. Did you enjoy the trip?
Loved it. Yeah,
That's awesome.
totally, totally loved it. I mean, there were moments when that I didn't love, like spending 36 hours on a train going on three trains, going a total of 250 miles, zigzagging back and forth in India because somehow, again, without smartphones and GPS, somehow we had booked the wrong trains and we ended up on this, the last one. The carriage, the compartment of the train it should have seated about 32 people in all, and there must have been at least 100 people in there. We couldn't get to the toilets. We couldn't get to the doors. When we got to the station, the only thing we could do was clamber out the windows, drop our backpacks onto the ground, and jump after them. So I didn't enjoy that, but at the time I was happy I was doing it, and it was definitely a key moment of my life.
How long did the whole journey take? From the start to the end, ending in Kathmandu, how long did it take?
3 months.
And would you have it planned? One flight and a flight home from Kathmandu, and then everything else you guys were going to map out? Or you guys kind of had a general idea, or did you have like a set itinerary?
No, the only thing we had was a return ticket from New Delhi to London on Iraqi Airways, believe it or not.
Wow.
Stopping off at, I think it was Abu Dhabi and then at Baghdad. So I've been in Baghdad Airport.
What? Now, which is wild, by the way.
Yeah.
How different is the hippie trail from the Silk Road trail, or was it no comparison, completely different times?
Silk Road, meaning back in history or more recently?
More recently.
The Silk Road Trail, I think it's hard to talk about the Silk Road without bringing China into the
Okay.
factor. Into the equation. And the thing about the hippie trail was that it ended in 78, and this was just when China was about to, radically, radically transform itself because Chairman Mao was still in power up until, I guess, the mid 70s, and then there was the Gang of Four. And so when China began its turn towards capitalism, towards a Western economic model. That was the late 70s. But up until then, China was really hard to get into. Western travelers just did not go to China. So I know the Silk Road also covers other countries, but there's an overlap, especially in Iran, in Afghanistan, Eastern Turkey. So there's some overlap, but it's not the same. The hippie trail was definitely heading towards either Nepal or Sri Lanka.
I had on a celebrity chef, Andy Ricker, and he's been in Thailand for 40 or 50 years. Before, he was in on islands that people still barely go to, but still now that have blown up. So I'm so jealous of a guy like you who traveled to these cities that were untouched, nondescript, now they're tourist spots. You got to see rivers and lakes now when there's nothing there. Have you ever revisited any of the places? Because Andy's like, I have a tough time going back to some of these islands because I was there when it was just me and the locals, and now there's the Hiltons and this and that. So did you ever go back to any of them?
No, I and it was partly, it wasn't all entirely a deliberate decision. It was, it would have been very difficult to go back to Iran, for
Of
instance.
course, of course.
But a lot of the places have deteriorated and become somewhat unsafe. And especially once I had I'm the father of a couple of wonderful young adults. And once, but when I was the father of young children, I didn't particularly want to, and I'm sure my wife wouldn't have wanted me to take off to some of these places. But the most beautiful place that we visited was Kashmir. Have you ever been to Kashmir,
I
Mike?
have not. I have not.
It's fantastically beautiful, but now it is so militarized. It's one of the most dangerous places in the world because you've got an unstable border. It's not even officially called a border between Pakistan and India. It's called a, I think it's called a line of control or a line of something. And then there's China in the northern part. China also doesn't accept the border with India, so there's tensions there too. And India has brought in hundreds of thousands of troops. There's an Islamic insurgency which is, pretty much under control, but only because of the hundreds of thousands of troops. It is not a happy place these days. And yet, it was it imagine the Rockies, imagine Colorado or Alberta, but times two. That's what Kashmir was like, and to see that again, even if the it would just, it's not anything I want to do.
I'm glad you brought that up because you that and Kathmandu, Zeppelin, Janis Joplin, you brought this to my attention. I'm not a music guy. Bob Seger, I forgot who else. They sang about these places, but they were never there. That actually blew me away. Did that blow you away while doing your research? Like, wow, they sang about Kashmir and Kathmandu and never went there.
It really did. And I didn't know about the Bob Seger song Kathmandu, which is not about Nepal at all. I knew about the Janis Joplin song that mentions Kathmandu, which she recorded only a week before her death. But in particular, I was a fan of the English singer Cat Stevens, or Yusuf Islam, as he became called. And so his song Kathmandu was definitely one that I knew before I went there. And there are these websites, it just goes to show how you got to be careful sometimes with the internet, because there's a bunch of websites out there that purport to say where it was exactly that Cat Stevens wrote this song. It's all invented. It's crazy because he mentions a cabin, and at one point there was a coffee house, probably a weed house or a pot house or whatever in Kathmandu that was called the cabin, but that was kind of a coincidence. Or it was a coincidence to the extent that the cabin was mentioned in a Rolling Stone article that Cat Stevens had read while he was recuperating from tuberculosis in London. So he wrote a song about wanting to go to Kathmandu while he was ill in London. And then this somehow morphed into, Cat Stevens wrote this great song when he was here. And I managed to track down a recording on YouTube, which is not even there anymore, but it was there a few years ago, a recording of a concert he gave in Berkeley a few months after he wrote the song, in which he played it as the encore to the concert. It was what he finished on a high note, finished the concert on a high note, and then came back and did this gentle song, Kathmandu, just to ease people out of the concert. And in introducing the song, he said, "Yeah, I've never been to Kathmandu." So that was definitive, hearing him say that,
That is wild.
Yeah.
When you finished up, you fly back from Kathmandu. Do you just go back to Oxford? Do you go right back to school, or will you finish up with your studies already?
I basically finished up with my studies, and after a couple of months, I moved to Toronto and started to work as a freelance writer.
Because I was going to say, how do you go from that trip back to like a classroom? Like, okay, back to class. Like, it changes you.
It sure does. I didn't do that. Claire went back to the classroom, but in a different way. She trained to become a teacher, and then she went on to work in education throughout her whole career. But I have a restless kind of mind, Mike, and so journalism was a good career for me because when you're a reporter or a feature writer, you go from one thing to the next thing to the next thing to the next thing. So it was easier in a way, but always this trip, this experience of traveling in Asia was like part of, it had become part of who I was. It had become part of my identity.
And did it make you continue to travel more when you got back to Toronto and throughout your whole life? You still a traveler?
Not as much as I would have liked to have been in more recent years, but yeah, I haven't been to nearly as many countries as you, but I must have been to somewhere between 30 and 40 countries,
That's a lot,
and
yeah.
it's a decent number. Yeah, and I wrote, I've written a couple of other travel books. The one I'm most proud of is the one about endangered languages around the world.
That's what I was going to ask you next. I said you wrote other books about. Did you write languages, that book in Australia or the Arctic? Didn't you write different language books so languages fascinate you?
Yeah, definitely. And I was the language columnist at the Montreal Gazette for some years, which was a great job to have in a bilingual city like Montreal, because in Montreal English is influenced by Montreal French, but also by Yiddish and by some of the immigrant languages, Italian, Greek, that there are in Montreal. Same as New York City. Montreal, in many ways, we model ourselves on New York. Toronto, they can model themselves on Cleveland or Pittsburgh, but Montreal models itself on New York. So yeah, getting back to your question. So I wrote one book about endangered languages. Spoken Here, it's called. Spoken Here, Travels Among Threatened Languages. So for that one, I went to Northern Australia and to south of France and to the Canadian Arctic and to Wales and the Isle of Man in the British
Oh,
Isles,
wow.
and to Oklahoma as well, to a little town near Tulsa named Sepulpa. And Sepulpa is the stronghold of a people called the Yuchi. They're not a recognized tribe. They're considered part of the Muscogee Creek, but the Yuchi have a language of their own that is isolated. It's unlike any other language. It's not related to Muscogee Creek. It's not related to Cherokee or any of the other languages of Oklahoma. And when I went there, it was 2001, and there were six or eight people who spoke the language fluently, and I met nearly all of them.
And this is going to sound silly. Obviously, they're bilingual. Is that how you communicated with them?
I communicated through English, yeah.
And now this is going to make me, because when I have so many authors on who write nonfiction books, you just said 2001. When I read a book or finish a book, I want to watch a documentary on it, and some books just stick with you. Does that stick with you? Like, you follow up with them. What are they doing now? There was only eight of them. How many of them are left? Does that ever like, or you have to kind of distance yourself because you'd be just consumed with all your books?
Yeah, that great question. I haven't followed up with them as much as maybe I should, but I have checked on the internet and I've seen that the guy who I wrote to, who was my contact there, he was a professor at a college nearby and partly of Yuchi origin, not entirely, but partly. He was about 35 or 40 at the time. He was teaching his kids to speak Yuchi, and he had access to the elders. The thing was that most of these elders would not be alive anymore. I mean, they were in their 60s or 70s, or in one or two cases, their 80s when I met them more than 20 years ago. And it was a struggle for them to. I mean, they were great people, wonderful people, but they were not people who used email. They were not people who read books, smart people, but not people I could follow up with very easily. So I did have a brief contact after the book came out with the professor, and then I lost touch with him.
How did you even find a group of less than a dozen people? How did that even come on your radar?
Just through Googling, even back then, through contacting, just through reaching out to. All you need is one or two contacts in each community. It was the same in Northern Australia. I knew that I wanted to go there because in Australia it's really incredible. There were not a large number of Aboriginal people, but there were a very large number of Aboriginal languages in Australia, and so I found. By Googling, I found one or two names, one or two people, and they put me in contact with one or two more people. And then I just arranged I would fly to Darwin in Northern Australia. Then when I got to Darwin, I took a small plane to get to a particular community of like 3,000, 2,000, 3,000 people. And there I made the most important contact, which was with a guy who was he was an electrician. He wasn't an academic or anything. He was an electrician, but he sensed how important it was to try and record a few of these languages before they disappeared. So that book opens with me standing in what in Australia they called an outstation. Here we call it a hamlet, or a like it's way smaller than a small town, just a collection of a few houses. And in this hamlet, I met a man called Patrick Nudjulu, and Patrick was one of the last three speakers of his language.
Three.
Three.
See, that blows me away.
But here I'm going to blow you away a bit more. One of them was a guy who lived in a different village.
No.
And the third was his own sister. But Patrick's own sister, he could not talk to her because in Australian Aboriginal culture, or it, with some groups, not all groups, but some groups, after puberty, boys and girls, men and women, are forbidden to talk to each other.
Even sister.
Even, especially sister. It's like the incest taboo.
So
Brothers
three people who
speak.
spoke it weren't even near each other. Two of them couldn't speak.
Exactly.
Wow.
So Patrick had married a woman who spoke a somewhat larger Aboriginal language, one with a few thousand speakers. So he talked to her in that language, and then to the outside world, he had reasonably good English, not great English, but reasonably good English. But his own language, it was called Metike. Metike, he couldn't speak to anybody. I said, "Who do you talk it to?" And he said, "I talk it in my dreams."
Oh, I'm actually have to. I have two books on the queue. That's gonna be my third book I'm gonna read now. I have to read it now. You just sold me on it. And I want to speak about Kathmandu and all this. That sounds incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. Yeah.
I know you have the move going. What's next for you, book wise? Do you have things in your? Do you have like a list of like, okay, I want to maybe do this next, do this next? Is that hard to like think what? Because you know it's an investment to put all that stuff in. Like you're putting time. That's a lot of work.
It's got to be something I feel passionate about.
Okay.
It can't be anything that just interests me. You know, I have a lot of things that interest me, but that doesn't mean I could write a good book about them. And I've begun a few books and or done some research, and then I've given them up because I thought, you know, this isn't something that really touches my heart. So I'm a little superstitious about talking to people,
Yeah, of
but
course.
there's one thing, one topic that I do feel kind of passionate about. So when I get settled, I'm going to get down to work.
Last time you read a review, do you go on Amazon and read reviews or no?
Yeah, I can't help myself sometimes.
Yeah. You love it. You spoke about it. You do it. Poetry. What is it about that speaks to you about poetry? Because some people have it, some people don't. What is it about poetry that you just love?
It's the intensity. And but I have to say I don't read nearly as much of it as I used to do when I was when I was a kid. Poetry is like one of those things that, you know, it's like music. When, you know, the songs that I heard when I was 16, 18 years old, they're still in my head, they're still in my heart, they're still rolling around inside my nervous system. I can hear a song now, you know, like even, you know, to take a current example, Texas Hold'em, you know, great song, but it's not going to be anything that I'll be earworming to myself 5 years from now. Whereas stuff that, you know, by the Stones or by Led Zeppelin or whoever that mattered to me when I was 18 years old, that's always going to be with me. It's kind of the same with poems. The poems that I memorized, that I chose to memorize, that I wanted to when I was 16 or 18, they're always going to be part of me. Whereas I can read a poem now and I don't have the same visceral reaction to it that I used to.
Ready to finish up with some quick hit questions?
Oh, God, I suppose so.
One city in any period of time you wish you could have visited.
Venice in the Middle Ages.
Oof, okay. How about one sporting event in history you wish you could have witnessed live? Front row seat to any sporting event in history.
The Montreal Canadiens playing the Soviet national ice hockey team when they were touring North America for the first time in the 70s.
Wow. What book are you reading now?
I am rereading The Lord of the Rings, which I have not read for more than 50 years.
Oh, really? Now, is it
Yeah.
coming back to you? Are you enjoying it?
I'm loving it. You know, it mattered a lot to me when I was a teenager, and then I saw the movies. I liked the movies, but I didn't love the movies. So I'm going back and giving that one more chance.
Last show you binged watched.
Oh, Joe, that's a tough one. Because I don't tend to binge watch very much, but one that I really did was, I mean, this was a few years ago though, was Mad Men.
You enjoyed it.
Loved it.
And how about this? Coolest souvenir or piece of memorabilia from your travels?
A polar bear tooth inscribed with a drawing of an Inuit hunter and a polar bear.
And where'd you get it from?
Baffin Island in northern Canada.
Mark, this was a blast. The book is Strange, Bewildering Time, Istanbul to Kathmandu in the Last Year of the Hippie Trail. The book is awesome. I want to read your other book. I'm going to assume it's awesome because you sold it so well. I can't wait to read it. Good luck with the move, and let's keep in touch. Mark, this was a blast. Can you just plug your site so everybody can find you? Because your website's pretty cool, too.
Yeah, it's markabley.com, MarkAbley.com. Mike, you were a fantastic interviewer. Thank you so
Oh,
much.
thank
Really
you, my
enjoyed
friend.
this.
We will keep in touch. We'll have a bagel war soon, and we'll chat soon.
And I will win the bagel war. Okay.
Mark,
Thanks a lot.
enjoy, and good luck with the move, brother.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend. Bye-bye.